Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Plus Four podcast, exploring the big wide world of Hickory Golf. I'm your host, Rob Berman. Episodes of this podcast reflect the personalities, the passion, and the pursuit of the game as it was played in the pre-1935 era across the world. Please subscribe and hit the like button to help us build our network of golfing fans coordinated in the United States through the Society of Hickory Golfers, and visit us online at plus4.org. In this episode, I get to learn about the story of the golf ball from one of the leading experts in the field, Kevin McGimpsey, author of numerous books on golf ball collecting and the chief appraiser for golf at the famed Bonhams Auction House. There is a point early in the conversation where we refer to a collector named Dick. This is Dick Esty. His full name comes up later in the conversation. Dick had a marvelous and world-class golf collection and everything one can imagine within it. Golf balls, artwork, antique clubs, clubmakers' tools, etc. Several of us got to visit with him in his Portland, Oregon home a number of years ago, just 1 year before he passed. I wrote up that visit, replete with numerous photographs of the collection, on the Northwest Hickory Players website. I'll put a link to that article in the show notes. I want to thank Kevin for his gracious time and passion for the game and urge you to stay tuned until the end when he shares the story of caddying in the 1986 Masters and being grouped with, you guessed it, Jack Nicklaus in the practice round. 1986 was a good year for Jack, as we all know. The story is very entertaining. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy the episode. Kevin, I'd like to begin a little bit by learning about you and your background and what led you into publishing your books.
Well, I'm Canadian by birth, but brought up in Northern Ireland. I left Canada when I was about 9 months old, and quite a good pedigree of golf in the family. My father was a two handicapper, and he was a golf rep for Wilson Staff.
Oh, yes.
And my younger brother became the amateur champion and a Walker Cup player, Walker Cup captain, and he worked for Titleist.
Oh.
So going back to my father, the garage was always filled with golfing samples. And I can still remember bright red colored hole highs and Wilson Staff golf balls. And there must have been something just in the back of my mind all the time that maybe golf balls was a thing for me to collect in sort of as a golf heritage thing. And that's what sort of kicked it off.
Now, I know you got to be a fairly accomplished player as well.
No. The best I was ever was eight.
Eight. Yeah. That's about the same as me.
Right.
At my best. And where was this in Ireland?
Little seaside town called Bangor, which is about 14 miles east of Belfast. It's a parkland golf course. And our family home was situated opposite the first tee.
And I'm guessing you were born in the 1950s?
52.
Yeah, good. And so how many books have you published to this date? I know some of them were before you got into golf, weren't they?
Yes, I've done two books on antique toys. And I've done two or three books on matchbox toys, which was quite a popular collectible in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then recent times, I've probably done four or five golf books, of which two were general golf memorabilia, and one was the big book, The Story of the Golf Ball.
Right. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. I know you used to run the Chester Doll and Toy Museum before you devoted your focus to golf. How has that experience impacted the world that you live in today?
Toys was a hobby as a boy. And I went into business with my best school friend, who was obviously from Northern Ireland, living in England. And we just had a great opportunity to curate and buy and display and research on antique toys and thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was one reason why I had to get into golf, because I'm obviously an innate collector and I couldn't collect toys because every toy we bought, we had to sell. If we didn't put it into the museum. So I had to find something else to fix this collecting bug. And that's why I turned to golf and then to golf balls.
And that museum continues today?
No, my partner Stuart, he got a really good offer in the private sector, which sort of forced her hand, and we decided then just to call it a day. Mm-hmm. But at that time, then that opened up an opportunity for me to join Bonhams, the auction house.
Yes.
They took me on as their golf expert.
Yes.
And life continued.
Good. I definitely want to talk about that. You know, you remind me of something. I've had the pleasure of seeing some private collections in the golf community, and I have some more on my schedule. And when I first started doing this, I was dismayed a little bit by all of this precious material sitting often in people's private homes. But then I realized, after I thought about it a little bit, as obviously we're only stewards of these objects, we don't technically own anything, and they'll hopefully pass from this generation to the next generation. Mm. I guess that's what happened with your museum collection.
Yes, it did. It went to auction, and we both agreed to keep a couple of things back as mementos. Mm-hmm. And yes, they went to auction, and off they went. That was it.
Right. Yeah. So eventually they become part of somebody else's collection, and hopefully yes. For the next 800 years, this continues.
Let's hope so. Absolutely right.
Now, in terms of your golf books, are there main markets for your books?
Well, the story of the golf ball book, that was the big one in 2003. And I thought that was the end of it. And sometimes I closed a chapter on it. I wasn't really going to look at it again. And I was out in Los Angeles about 4 or 5 years ago, and I was called into the country club to have a look at their golf ball collection. And mm-hmm. This really sparked something off again with me. I just couldn't believe it, that I was seeing golf balls that I hadn't seen before. And they sort of asked, well, could you catalogue? And I thought, well, anybody could just go to the book and catalogue from the book. But then I looked at the book again, and there were so many inaccuracies and mm-hmm. ambiguities and errors. And I thought, gosh, this is just terrible. But again, it sparked this desire to sort of research and try and improve. And that's what then came about in the first two folios in the golf ball directory, where I'm putting right things that were wrong. But because now I've got the internet, and I didn't have that 20 years ago, the research is so much wider.
Now, your trip to the LA Country Club, was that for insurance valuation for their benefit?
It was only because I was on pure luck. I was on holiday in California, uh-huh. and I got the phone call, and I went up. Yes, yeah, so they wanted to basically ascertain what they had. And you mentioned earlier on in one of your emails about the Park Royal ball.
Yes.
They suddenly pulled one of these out of a cardboard box, and the curator asked me what I thought of it, and I told him it was a pretty lovely looking golf ball. And again, this is all part of the fun, isn't it? Seeing something that you haven't seen for a long, long time, or seeing some of a ball in that lovely condition.
Is the Park Royal the hexagonal ball I sent you a picture?
That's right.
Of? Oh, yes. Okay. I didn't even know the name of it.
It's actually, I looked it up. It's got Royal on it.
Oh, okay. I've got, let me bring that picture up on screen just for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Here it is. So that's a Park Royal ball.
There it is there. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And this is part of Dick's collection.
Yes. Did you know Dick?
Yes, I did. Yeah. He came to my house for dinner, and I stayed at his place for a couple of nights.
Yeah. Lovely. I was grateful to know him before he passed.
Yes.
I took this photograph. Right. He showed us around his whole collection, but it wasn't until I got home that I realized that golf ball isn't even round.
No, it's not. But basically, it's as I've done in my book here, it was patented in 1896, patent number 11781, and the idea was that he made these flattened panels in the shape of hexagons, so that the ball would be slowed down when it was on fast greens.
Oh, I can see the word royal on this now that you mentioned it.
There it is, yes. But I would say it was a complete, utter disaster.
Yes, I can imagine.
I think he was maybe just making a ball just to sort of show off a little bit. Probably didn't believe that it was going to do anything on fast greens. And I've probably seen maybe 4 or 5 in my time. So maybe there's maybe no more than 10 extant.
And this is Willie Park Jr., is it?
Yes, yes.
Wow. That's incredible. Wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll post that picture in the show notes for the listeners.
Do you want to know what it's worth?
Sure. Yeah.
About 15,000.
Wow.
Which is about 20,000. No, but about $18,000.
Oh, that's pounds. I see.
Yeah. It's easy enough just to, you know, go up. Yeah. As a rough guide.
It's obviously gutta-percha.
Gutta-percha, solid.
Yeah. Yes. Just a few years before the Haskell.
Yes.
Very interesting. You won the Murdoch Medal from the British Golf Collectors Society in 2004 for the story of the golf ball. Can you take us back to that day when you received the honor? What was that like?
It came out of the blue. One of the committee members rang me up to tell me that I was going to receive the medal. Could I be at a certain place at a certain time at one of the meetings to do mm-hmm. so? And that's the medal there.
Beautiful. It looks like a Kirkwood medal.
It is, yeah. Kirkwood did it.
Oh, yes. Beautiful.
Yeah, it is good. So it says, Murdoch Medal, conspicuous contribution to the literature of golf. Yeah, so I was just over the moon with it and really, really pleased.
What on earth can we say about David Kirkwood?
David Kirkwood is a real character.
Yes.
I love the guy, you know. I used to be scared stiff of him in the early days. You walk into a room with that big red face of his, and you think, what have I said, Rock? But he's such a lovely guy.
Yeah, you know? He's got so much energy. It makes me laugh just thinking about him. I sat across the table at dinner with him last October over in Scotland, and it was the first time I got a chance to meet him. And it was though I knew him my whole life.
Yes,
such a funny guy.
And he's a real canny Scotsman, obviously, because we went to a little trade show in November. I bought a couple of things from his lovely wife, and David wasn't there. And then I brought a couple of books down that David had pre-ordered. Mm-hmm. And there was £10 difference in so I said, oh, well, let's just call it quits, shall we?
Right.
And he didn't like it, but he had to accept it. So he walked away £10 down on the deal.
That's great. Now he's in essence managing Archie Baird's collection. You must know that collection.
Yes.
I do, yeah. It's absolutely good of him to do that. I hope that has a life beyond David's time.
I think it will. And whereas David helped me on Folio One, and I described him as a member of Gullen, mm-hmm. And the second time he helped me, and I described him as David Kirkwood, Heritage Golf Museum, Gullen, Scotland.
Yes, yeah.
And I thought that's a bit more appropriate.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
If we leave the Dutch game aside for a minute, is it your belief that the first Scottish golf balls were made out of wood?
Yes, just about. It's so far, it's so long, 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 long gone that, you know, and they talked about the size of cannonballs and they sort of this. Yes, they probably were. They probably were.
Oh, I have no opinion about it. I really know nothing about it. I just thought I'd ask you.
Yeah. No, I think they probably were. And I think the feather ball, the leather ball with the feathers inside, probably did come in round about sort of, the 1600s or the late 1500s. Mm-hmm. And very perishable because there's no survivors today.
Yeah. Both of those are organic materials, both samples.
Yes.
Is it possible, Kevin, to distill the story of the golf ball in an elevator speech for somebody that isn't a golfer? What would you tell somebody?
There's three important aspects to golf. Mm-hmm. There's the player, there's the club, and there's the ball. Well, we don't have to talk about the player because they come and go. The club has developed over the years. And one reason why the golf club, I think, is so much more collectible than the golf ball is because the golf club actually can be used by hickory players. Mm-hmm. So the club has actually reinvented itself and has extended its appeal in its life. The golf ball itself it's perishable. You lose it. Mm-hmm. You can't play with it again. And you're certainly not going to play with a golf ball that's worth $15,000. So that's the importance of it. So it's up there with the player and the club. And over the years, it's changed from feather-filled leather globe to a hard kind of rubber to then to another kind of rubber up to the very present day when it looks more or less like it did 100 years ago, but technically it's a lot different.
Yeah. Probably this obviously is maybe trite, but the lawnmower and the golf ball are probably the two things that have built the game more than anything. Have you ever hit a wood golf ball?
Never hit a wooden golf ball.
Okay.
No.
I don't know if anybody really does that, but I've never done it myself. I was curious about that.
I think the damage to the long nose clubs or the scared necks clubs would just be horrendous.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just wouldn't be worth doing.
Yeah. Now you mentioned Bonhams. Can you tell us what that experience was like? I don't know if you still do it, but I know you were involved here in the US as well as in the UK.
Yes. Well, luckily enough, Bonhams took over from Philips. It was a buyout. So Bonhams became quite a big organization on the stage, probably still the same today, you know, behind Sotheby's and Christie's, but still pretty, pretty big. And by luck for me, Bonhams was situated in Chester. That's where they ran the golf from. Because way back, a guy called Bob Garland, you may know.
Mm-mm.
Bob Garland was Mr. Golf. He sort of set up the golf auctions under Phillips, again, from the Chester office. So when Bonhams took over, he then retired. Somebody else took over. So when that retirement came about, Bonhams had a short list of people, and I was just so lucky because I lived 10 miles from the office. And I was asked in, and my knowledge at the time was pretty good on golf balls, not bad on golf clubs, but other things I was quickly learning, and I learned and learned and learned.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there for nearly 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
What goes into putting estimates together for an item?
Gut feeling. Research, maybe just those two things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're also led by the feelings of the owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's actually quite an important aspect. Yeah, if they think it's worth £1,000, and you know it's only worth £100, then you can say, well, we can maybe compromise a little bit, but. You know, that's going to affect the estimate, and it's not going to sell if you're going too unrealistic an offer.
Did you have some pretty interesting experiences with online or telephone bidders that you could tell us about? Bonhams had some really important collections in recent years, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can remember the Henry Cotton Medal from a 1937 or 1938 Open.
Mm-hmm.
That was a record at the time for. A round medal, not the sort of mm-hmm. the dime, you know, that shape, heraldic shaped medal from the 1890s. That got a really good price of about sort of £30,000 or £40,000. And then obviously the painting that Dick bought before he died, so the big calendar painting.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great piece. And
I know what he paid for it.
And he realized a lot of money for it.
Was
that
through Bonhams? That sale was through Bonhams?
That was Bonhams, yes.
Oh,
yes.
And was the putter also sold through Bonhams, or did he get that from the club?
No, because we had the putter and the painting from the club.
Now, so, Blackheath sold those items because they needed repairs, isn't that right?
No, I think they had the opportunity to buy the land that the golf club was on.
Okay.
So they could buy it from the leaseholder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the reason that motivated them.
Mm-hmm. I think they've put a replica in the clubhouse, but it really pained me to see that painting in Dick's living room.
Yes.
And now it shouldn't pain me, but I just thought, boy, that really belongs in the clubhouse.
Yes. Yes. I know. Yes. Yes. But anyway, it's in the, Dick bought it and that was it. So there you go.
Yeah. 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 Well, somebody would have bought it. He let us all hold that putter. And I wanted to ask you about that too. I mean, handling these sort of rarities for me is almost transformational. Mm-hmm. You must have seen incredible items through your day. What's it mean to you to hold these precious antiques? Does it mean anything to you?
Of course it does. You think back of the time, you think back about the player, if there's an association, you think back about the blacksmith who mm-hmm. crafted this beautiful club. You think of it, you know, where is it going to be in 100 years time from now? Hopefully it's going to be looked after. Hopefully, you know, it'll just continue. Yes, all sorts of golf pieces, whether it's a ball or a piece of artwork or a vase or a golf club, when it's old and it's valuable, you really do appreciate it.
At least for me, I feel like I can psychically channel what that might have been like to be one of the players, you know, and let's say in the late 18th century or something. Just to hold those really old golf clubs is very different than just looking at them.
Yes. Oh, absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, with a club, you look at, you can see the grip, you can see the wear and tear on it.
And the weight of it.
And the weight and the size of the head. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, are you a collector, Kevin?
Well, I collected golf balls.
Was that past tense?
Yes, because I sold my collection, the main run of the collection, I sold it at Bonhams about 15 years ago.
Okay.
And I had things like, you know, a couple of nice featheries, and I had a Penful man and a Dunlop man and a Silver King man, all the sort of the merchandising display points of which I always really find very interesting. But then it didn't all sell. So the 10% that didn't sell, that then formed the nucleus of a second collection. And I've been just quietly just adding a golf ball here and a golf ball there. And, you know, but it's like a lot of collectors say, the children aren't interested in them.
Yes.
So really, you've got to sort of draw a temperate line and say, don't get too carried away here, because it's just going to cause confusion when you move on to the 19th hole.
Yes. I've been in some people's garages, and you realize there can be a really serious sickness in collecting golf clubs.
Yes.
When you see 8,000 golf clubs in somebody's garage.
And they probably haven't cataloged them, and they don't know what they're leaving. And that's not a very nice thing to do, really.
Yeah, it is very difficult on the widows, but we all know this. Anyway, what about golf ball boxes? I know that's very collectible. I've never understood the allure of golf balls, collecting golf balls. I'm not saying I couldn't understand it. I just so far haven't gravitated that way. I know boxes and advertising, like you say, are very collectible too.
Well, I would say if you'd asked me, you know, what do people collect or why do they collect in golf balls? I would say the, you know, you start off with the feather era and then you come onto the sort of the rubber core era from the 1900s onwards. And then you look at the cover patterns.
Yes.
And then you look at the one we just talked about earlier, or you talk about a rifled pattern, or you talk about the stars and stripes. So or the bramble, the one that looks like the pimple, or the round dimple that we all know today. So collectors can look at these golf ball patterns and maybe find different 20 types to sort of interest themselves. Then you've got the wrap golf balls. Now, the wrap golf balls started in the late 1890s. Well, by the 1920s, these are just beautiful Art Deco, brilliantly colored Harlequin, staggeringly beautiful looking golf ball wrappers. So golf collectors can find those as well. And then that leads on to your golf boxes. Imagine finding a golf box, even if it's just empty, but it's got some lovely artwork on the front and lovely colors. Imagine opening that box and suddenly there were 10 wrapped golf balls. Where are the other two? Or sometimes you just find maybe 11 and there's one missing. But Even an empty golf ball box is fantastically interesting, because it'll tell you what maybe the ball inside was like. It'll tell you what the age of the golf box was. And they're just lovely things to have as well.
You sound like we're discovering King Tut's tomb. I just love it. There's a photo on your website of Will Easton's collection in Idaho. All of the balls are wrapped. That seems like a very special collection. Can you tell us what his story is?
Well, I never met Bill. I'm sorry, well, William. Will, but we've emailed each other several times. I think he's around about my age. And that's what he collects. He collects wrapped golf balls. And when you see a photograph like that, to me, it's lovely.
Unexpected.
They're clean, they're bright, they're old. I mean, those golf balls are all nearly over 100 years old, and there they are in perfect condition. I mean, as a golfer, you remember probably going onto the first tee with that wrapped golf ball, the ball that was going to actually unleash, you know,
your record score.
Record score. And you unwrapped it and you showed off, and it was a crinkle here and a crinkle there. Those days are lost, I think. I think the golf manufacturers, once in a while, should actually just come up with a limited edition wrapped golf ball. Just
good idea. So just for the listener's sake, this is a photograph of a golf ball rack like you would see in many offices in the world, but all of the balls are still wrapped. So if you don't mind, I'll repost that picture on the show notes.
Yes, yes.
It was really intriguing to see it.
Yes, good, good.
Have you ever tried hickory golf, Kevin?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. I had a half set about 10 years ago. I stopped playing because I got a bad back, and that was just putting too much pressure on me. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And the slower you swing, the easier it is. And I love it. I wouldn't give up my steel shafts on a Saturday though. I still enjoy playing with my friends
competition.
Yeah.
Now, again, I've admitted I'm a novice in this area for golf ball collecting. Obviously, condition is key. Can you talk about some of the other factors that make a ball desirable?
Yes. Well, rarity is obviously an important point. When I was doing some research recently, I suddenly realized that during the Second World War periods, you know, let's say 1940 and 1946, especially in the United States, so mm-hmm. many golf balls were reprocessed. And if you look at the adverts, you'll see that that all the manufacturers, Worthington, Titleist, Wright & Ditson, they're all saying, we cannot supply you with golf balls, but you send us in a golf ball that is in reasonable condition. We will reprocess that and send you an equivalent golf ball back. And that made me think there must have been thousands and thousands, if not millions, of golf balls that actually were plucked out of the garage, out of a collection, never mind found on a golf course, and then changed forever. So those golf balls from the 1920s and 30s mm-hmm. were probably then given a new life, and they don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And that creates great rarity.
Are you saying that the balls were repurposed for the war effort, or they were used as a ball?
They were reprocessed for golfers who were still playing golf.
Yeah.
Because basically, by 1941, certainly in the United Kingdom, there was no such thing as a golf ball. Mm-hmm. They were all making rubber tires for the war effort.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that was the same in America. So this was purely for recreational purposes. We can't make new golf balls. We're not allowed to, but we can do this to keep the game going.
Right. That was interesting. When I read your folios, the recovering of the balls was an interesting thing. You have pictures of the advertisements and things like that.
Yes, yes.
I wasn't aware of that.
No. Well, I think that's quite a, it's a recent revelation to me, actually, that that's why, relatively speaking, there are so few golf balls available for collectors. Mm. And going back to the auction days, over 20 years, you do see collections coming back onto the market. You see the same golf ball that was sold, that very, very same golf ball was sold at auction in 1985. And here it is at auction in 2022.
Yeah. Well, let's jump from that to the Harry Wood collection. I don't know a lot about the collection. I think Dick had some of the Harry Wood golf balls.
Yes.
Can you tell us just a little background on that collection? Do you know much about that?
Well, he's basically attributed to being the first serious collector of golf memorabilia. Mm-hmm. He was based in Manchester at the old Manchester Golf Club, which is about 35 miles from where I live in Chester. And he had various scouts and sources all around Scotland trying to find him the old relics, things that were unusual, clubs and balls. And he then amassed this and put them on display in the old Manchester Golf Club, where they stayed until about the 1980s when they were bought up by two collectors.
And so the collection was divided. I think Wood was, 1910s, 1920s himself?
Even earlier. Yeah, you're probably right. Sorry, that's right. Yes, yes, it was, yeah.
I see. Also, so go ahead.
And he affixed onto the balls a rather unique little sticker.
Yes.
Which sometimes he wrote on it in ink to say what the club was or what the ball was. Mm-hmm. And these still add a lot of cachet just because of the provenance.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've played with a number of replica balls, the Bramble, the Line Cut, hand hammered, smooth, mostly gutty and feathery balls. The Bramble, to me, from my experience, rolled faster on greens because it has less surface contact. Have you played with a Bramble, or do you, was that part of the thinking of that shape, do you think?
It's a very, very good question. And I think you've answered it. I think you've answered it rolled well on the green. It didn't hold much debris.
Yes. Whereas
the recess dimple ball did. And aerodynamically, I think it was actually a very, very good ball.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they bring it back with the Cayman balls when they were trying to use them on the sort of the short and golf courses in the Cayman Islands?
I don't know.
And I think you'll find that they were of a Bramble pattern. So obviously it did still work.
Good.
Okay.
Let's talk for a minute about colors of golf balls. What can you tell listeners about that?
Well, obviously the most common color is white. Golf balls that were being made in Scotland in the 1890s, they started to paint them, and red became a popular color. We used to think all the time that it was because of the frosty conditions, so that the red would stand out.
Mm-hmm.
But more people find it was because of the daisies on the fairways.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hit a white ball into there, you wouldn't find it. So the red, again, was a sort of a significant color and easy to find. Blue has been used. I've seen a Silvertown golf ball from the 1890s in a pale blue. I don't know why. And I've also seen some golf balls from the 1920s, 1930s. They've been painted in yellow, red, blue, and silver.
And does the color of a gutta ball make a difference to its value? Maybe not.
It does, actually, because it's a little bit more exceptional and a little bit rarer.
If it's lighter?
If you've got a nice collection of golf balls and they're all white, that's fine. But if you've got something that's interspersed with some colors to break up,
right,
that always helps.
Obviously, if a ball is still in its wrapper, that heightens the value of it, I would imagine.
As a rule of thumb, I say it doubles it.
Oh, it doubles it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It might even treble it.
I've seen also people have balls where the wrapper has been opened that can increase the value much, can it?
Well, then you're going to... It does.
A little,
probably adds another 50% as a rule of thumb. Because again, it's ephemera and it's easily destroyed.
Yes. I've been amazed as a golf club collector that often golf balls will sell for multiples of what golf clubs sell for. Has the market cooled from its high point, or what could we say about that over the last 20 or 30 years?
That's a good question. The peak of the golf ball market, I would say, was the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've had various sort of economic recessions and things like that. And that obviously affects things. Because it's quite a sort of small niche market. And this is maybe what I should have said earlier on when we first started to talk. I'm talking about traditional golf balls. You know, there are people out there, if you look on the internet, who collect logo golf balls. There are people who collect signature golf balls. If you go onto Facebook and you'll see that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds who call that's part of their golf ball collecting logos.
Yes.
Not to go any further, but I don't understand why you would collect logo golf balls. And I don't want that going onto the podcast. It's be too offensive. But I can understand signature golf balls, whereby there are people who want to collect a golf ball with Tiger Woods' name on it, or Seve Ballesteros, or old Tom Morris. I can understand that. But they're all part and parcel of the golf ball fraternity. And as a whole, it's very important.
And are you a believer that Tom Morris actually signed any golf balls? Did he do that? I think I've seen a picture of one at the museum in St. Andrews, but it doesn't appear to be an actual handwritten signature.
No, there is a Tom Morris ball in the clubhouse there, and I don't think it's got Tom Morris's signature on it.
Yeah.
No. Alan Robertson, his yes. He signed some, I know that.
Yeah.
Not. I don't think Tom Morris did.
Well, let's jump to Alan for a minute. Alan's one of my favorite people in history. Yeah. He's a third generation golf ball maker.
Yeah.
I have a few questions about him. Are any examples of either his father or his father's father's balls in existence that you know of?
His father's balls, there are some examples.
And he was David Robertson?
But not any older than that.
And Alan would put a number on his balls. I imagine that's the grams of weight of the ball. Is that what that is?
Well, we call it the DWT, which mm-hmm. basically was either the weight or the size.
Okay.
And it sort of, over the years, that sort of slightly changed because it's more of a sort of a weight thing rather than a size thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, he would put a 29 on it to indicate that's what the ball weighed.
Now, with all of your travels working with Bonhams, were you able to see some pretty special collections over the years?
Yes. I went to Valderrama and saw Mr. Patino's collection.
Mm-hmm.
And that was wonderful. I went to Dick Estes' house in Palm Springs and saw part of his collection because the main collection was obviously in Oregon.
Yes.
Portland. Which I didn't see. Mm. Portland, yeah. Privately, yes, I've seen quite a few sort of private collections, and some came into Bonhams for cataloging and some didn't. But I think the last collection I saw in the States was by a chap called Roberto. And he was of the old school. And yes. We did quite a good job on it, but not as good as he'd hoped, but that's the way it was.
Obviously the photos, and you know, it's nice that the hammer prices are available. I've looked at all of those clubs, and it's a great way for people like me to learn.
It is a great way. I think an auction catalog is worth an awful lot more when it's got the prices realized in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that's what that club was worth on that day. And that's important.
Yes. Now, I'd love to ask you about the Cochran's Terrestrial golf ball. That's a ball that I've always been enamored with. Could you mm-hmm. tell us, is there a story behind that? I think all of them were technically Bramble balls. And is the Terrestrial the same as the Map of the World ball?
Well, you've answered that question. Yes, it is. It's mm-hmm. sometimes called the Globe ball, sometimes called the Terrestrial ball, and sometimes called Map of the World ball. And Cochran, I think, called it the Terrestrial ball, whereas the golf magazines called it the Map of the World ball.
Mm-hmm.
They're all Bramble, and they've all got the continents in relief. There's also a registered design number that you see on the ball, which was obviously copywriting the design.
Mm-hmm.
Why they were made, again, I think it was just basically to show that they could do something a little bit unusual.
Right.
And as to surviving numbers, in my time, I've probably auctioned 6 different ones, one of which was very, very badly distressed,
mm-hmm.
And one was absolutely mint. And there's probably maybe less than 20 known mm-hmm. to exist today.
So I wonder if there was only one mold ever for that ball.
I would say yes.
Uh-huh.
I would say yes. And I don't think he would have made more than maybe 1,000 at the mm-hmm. time. And why, again, we'll never know.
It is fun. Got it. Yeah. It just speaks to me when I saw that for the first time, I don't know, mm-hmm. a few years ago.
Yes.
It just looks like a fun thing to have.
It is. Absolutely.
I would say also, you mentioned some of these already, but for me, the Stars and Stripes ball is really appealing, and the Davidson rifle ball. Yes. I can't imagine what that ball plays like, but nobody would hit one of these anymore, would they?
What, a real one?
Yeah, a real one.
No.
No, they're way too valuable.
Far, far, far too valuable, yeah. Yes. Yes. So if I remember correctly, the story about the Stars and Stripes ball was that one came into an American auction house, and then one of the collectors, really, really aggressive buyer, asked the auctioneer, where did it come from? And he said, it came in from Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And the collector then went up to Maine and narrowed it down to an area, but he started putting in adverts into the local stores and shops, you know, ball like this wanted. And eventually he got a phone call and went back up, and family had these golf balls. They thought they were baseballs.
Oh.
Baseball balls.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, he acquired another 10 of them from the family and from his hard work and diligence.
Nice. Yeah. Now, I'm also a fan of Peter Paxton, and I know he made of golf balls. I've only ever seen one online. Do you see them at all? Do they come up?
No, not very often. No.
Yeah. I reached out to somebody online that had one that he found in the dirt somewhere, and he wouldn't part with it. But
he was quite a prolific golf ball producer, factory, and he made four or five different types of balls, you know, again, which would be in the book. I can't remember them offhand now, but
I play with a lot of Peter Paxton clubs, and that's why I ask. Okay. In some of your work, I've read about efforts to outdo the Haskell ball when that came out, and there were many, many competitors, liquid-filled balls, air-filled balls, floating centers. That era with patents and competition obviously was rife with competition. How could you explain how that all shaped out? Was it that the Goliaths won the day? Because I know there were patent wars and battles from overseas. Everybody wanted to corner the market, didn't they?
Well, the Haskell ball was really so unique. Mm-hmm. A court case in the British Isles, which was a patent case, showed that although there had been rubber cores wound with windings, they were never wound under tension, mm-hmm. and this was completely a completely novel new way of making a golf ball. And although they had something like maybe 15 years of patent protection, and they sold licenses to Spalding and Worthington and St. Mungo that they could make these balls under license, nobody else got a look in. The only way they could do it is do it illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty ruthless in making sure that they didn't go onto the market very often.
Right.
So basically Haskell and then these six licensees, they had a monopoly on golf ball development until probably the 1920s.
I was curious, this air-filled ball, it sounds like they would have a rubberized center, which they would later insert a needle into, basically, and fill it with air.
Well, it's called the pneumatic.
Mm-hmm.
And Goodyear were the ones who came up with this idea. And it was on the market for probably 6 to 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it had compressed air in the center of the ball, but it did have a tendency to have leakage,
mm-hmm.
and you could end up with a rather sort of saggy looking golf ball,
sure.
which wasn't particularly fun to play with.
I live out here in Port Townsend, Washington, which is 2 hours west of Seattle, and at our local driving range, I got a liquid center golf ball one day. And oh my God, it was so much fun. And I went out and I went online and bought a dozen antique liquid center balls. I haven't used them yet, but they're still wrapped.
Right. Yeah.
They're not valuable, but I love that idea.
Yes, absolutely. Well, then obviously then the 1920s, 1930s, then that became a really important time for what the manufacturers were like. Putting honey into the center of a golf ball, you know, for the Hagen golf balls.
Really?
Mercury was earlier than that. Yeah, honey was the big thing in the 1930s.
And Walter Hagen put his name on that?
He did. That's all coming out in Folio 3, which is the next phase is 1920 to 1945.
Uh-huh.
And there's an awful lot of Hagen golf balls with honey centers.
It sounds on brand.
Yeah.
now, do you know, is the golf ball that Alan broke 80 with at the Old Course, is that ball someplace? Do we know? It may not have been saved.
I don't think it's certainly not the RNA. Because I've gone through their collection several times, and I noticed that. No,
Obviously, for a long time, I don't know when balls were standardized, but obviously whether a ball was actually round or how much it weighed was somewhat arbitrary for many, 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 probably centuries. Yes. Do you know, were players with Allen and others notating a numeral on their balls? I would assume certain better players might have gravitated to try to find consistency in a ball. Do we know anything about that?
No, only as you've said, a player, a golfer, would have had a preference. Mm-hmm. He would have had a preference ball maker, and he would have a preference weight and size. And the golf ball only underwent some kind of standardization in 1920. Mm-hmm. Until 1920, you could play with a golf ball of any size, any weight, any color, whatever you wanted to do. But the USGA and the RNA got together in 1920 and started to come together to try and put some kind of limit on the distance a golf ball could go. And it's ironic that here we are 103 years later and they're still talking about it.
Yeah. Wasn't the British and the American ball different in size for a long time?
But yes, the USGA and the British the RNA, they worked together for about 10 years. And 1920, it was 1.62. Then it went down to 1.55. Then it went up to 1.68. So by 1930, the Americans had agreed on a ball, which I think is the present 1.68 size. But the British said that was too big. Mm-hmm. And the British waited until 1970 before they concurred and joined the Americans.
Now, I've seen these metal flat credit card-like devices with a hole in the middle where you could find if your ball was round. Is there a name for that thing?
A gauge.
A gauge, that's all? That's what they call it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the people who made the map of the world, Cochrane's, they brought out a brass gauge, which were made available to golfers. And obviously on one side, there was an advertisement. But on the other side, it said exactly what the regulation standard the size of the ball was.
And brass is soft. Is there a purpose for it being brass? Do you know?
No, just quality.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Other manufacturers brought it out and used a cardboard one, but that obviously didn't last very long.
Were there any women golf ball makers that you know of?
Yeah, most golf balls were made by women in the factories, but not feather, you know, not that era. But by the 1910s, mostly the factory workers were female.
I wonder though if anybody marketed a ball under their own name.
Yes, Wood Milne, Wood Milne. That was a British golf ball company, and they brought out a lady ball in the 1920s, specifically for women golfers.
Another ball that I was really impressed with in one of your folios is this ball called the AAA London, or Anderson, Anderson, Anderson. And your book says there's only one known to exist.
Yes.
That's incredible.
Well, this is a sort of, whereas earlier on I said about the fact that golf balls were made rare because of the war years. Another phenomena that's happened in the last 30 years is the arrival of what we call lake balls. And we're talking about, especially in the United Kingdom, there are two or three people who have devoted their lives to going around old golf courses, going into old water hazards and extracting old golf balls. And invariably, these Anderson ones, these AAA ones, have been lake balls and have been repainted and have then been put onto the market. And we wouldn't know of their existence if it hadn't been the fact that they've been found in lakes.
Yes, interesting.
Yeah.
Are there other wild stories of discoveries of rare balls that you could share with our listeners?
Yes. One I like was the greenkeeper of the new Loughness golf course up near Gullen. And there was land to the right of the existing golf course. and they were using the sand, you know, to take for the repairs around the golf course. And they started to find golf balls in this sand dune. And looking at the map of the old course, this was like an area where golf balls would have landed. And they found several old gutter golf balls, some of which have been shown in the book, and fantastic condition considering their age. The sand has preserved them, and they've still even got the lettering on them, William Park or George Duncan or whatever. Just there they are, and some of them came to auction, and the greenkeeper did very well out of them.
That's pretty neat. Yeah, I've heard stories, you know, golf club collectors that'll buy an old bag of clubs. The smart collectors always empty that bag and they turn it upside down because you just never know what's inside.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. There might be a golf ball or some tees.
Yeah.
You just never know. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yes. 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 Indeed. Yeah.
Also, until I saw your books, I never knew about the flat studs pattern. And that really looks appealing to me. I've never seen one in person, but again, just a marketing gimmick, I imagine.
Well, it's a continuation of the bramble. So they're protruding on top of the surface, but they've been flattened down and made a sort of a slightly larger circumference or diameter. I mean, yes, Wilson made one. I think it was 1919. They brought one out, and it's a lovely looking golf ball.
Yeah, I think so. What can you say about golf ball molds? I mean, they're also very expensive, the original ones. Are there many of them around? For instance, if somebody wanted to find one of these flat stud molds, is that a very, very hard thing to do?
Yes, very hard. Yes. The existing big brass molds that you might find at auction or see in a museum, they're invariably of the bramble pattern. Smaller ones would be found from the sort of 1930s, but again, they'll usually be mesh or the round dimples.
Right.
But they are about, but those three patterns really.
Now, I'd like to stray off of the topic just for a minute. I found a copy of your book, The Story of Golf, printed in Russian on the Bonham site. Is there a big market in Russia?
Well, the publishers came to me and said that they wanted to do this. So they did the Story of the Golf Ball book and the Golf Memorabilia book that I wrote with David Nish. And from what I've been told, they printed several thousand.
Wow.
I got 12 complimentary copies of each book. And it's fantastic, really.
For somebody that wanted to get into this area of collecting, what's your advice for a novice?
Do a little bit of research, see what sort of tickles your fancy. For instance, if I was starting again, I would collect patent golf balls. Any golf ball that's got a patent number on it, because that means then there's something interesting about it. And maybe it didn't last as long as something else. But I'm too old for that now, so that's come and gone, unfortunately. But that's what I would say to a collector who's got, you know, a little bit of money. You know, there's a nice area to concentrate on. Like all collectibles, buy what you can in the best possible condition. And don't buy it for an investment, but don't be foolish. Yes. And enjoy.
Good advice. How can people contact you or find your books?
Oh, well, that'd be very nice. I've got a little website called www.golfballbook.co.uk.
I will link to that in the show notes.
Thank you. Or I've got a personal email, which I'm quite happy to put out, which is kevin.prgolf.com. And I will reply to every email I get.
Wonderful.
Can I tell you an interesting story about Jack Nicklaus?
Yes, please. Yes, I know you were at the 86 Masters. Yes, please.
Yeah, do you know the story, the good story?
Well, I know you did a practice round with Jack.
Yeah, so you know the story, right?
Yeah, okay. But please tell us, please.
Oh, well, my father was alive, and he realized that Garth, my brother, was going to be out there, and he wrote a letter to Jack Nicklaus. And Jack Nicklaus wrote back and said, Well, I would love to meet your son, and if you'd like to join me for a practice day on the Tuesday, I'm playing with two other young American amateurs. We'll make up a four ball. So we got out there, and Garth was on the putting green, and I was in my white overalls and my green cap, and it was hot, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people around the putting green, and Nicholas came up to Garth and introduced himself. And he said, I'll see you on the first tee. And he walked off, and there's a big throng going towards the tee. And they got on the first tee, and Jack said, let's throw the balls up and see who's playing with each other. And Garth is playing with one of the American amateurs and against the other, against Jack and the other guy. And I said, and he said, we'll play for $5. And that was it. So off they went. And I can remember, well, he was 46, Jack Nicklaus, and I can remember they were playing the 13th at Amen Corner, and the three amateurs were 50 to 100 yards past his drive. We were looking back at Jack Nicklaus playing his, you know, brassy up to the the green. And we stopped one time. It was there was thunder and lightning, and we were sheltering. And I thought, oh, don't go in, you know, please, you know, just keep going. And Jack Nicklaus turned to one of them and said, I'm staying out here. I need the practice. So we thought, that's fantastic. And we stopped again for lightning, and but he continued on. So this went on, and it was great. And we got to the 18th, and Garth, my brother, and his partner, I think they'd beaten Jack 2-1. And they were shaking their hands, and that was it. And Garth saw the two American amateurs, you know, settle up the money. And Garth said to me, he said, Jack hasn't paid his bet. I said, Garth, you've just played with the greatest golfer ever. Who cares? If you probably just said that just as sort of as a fun little. And Garth said, well, okay, fair enough. Anyway, after the event was over and Jack Nicklaus was the Masters champion, and Garth went back to Ireland, he received a letter thanking Garth for the game of golf, and please find enclosed a check for $5.
A check.
the 1986 Masters champion.
That's which priceless.
Has obviously never been cashed and was framed, and just shows you how classy the guy was.
That's great. I love the way you describe him on his approach shot to 13 with a brassy in 1986.
Well, exactly. Yes, yes, yes. Exactly.
That speaks to our listeners.
That's good. That's good. And it was great. And Garth went out. There was a thing called a concession cup, which I'm not sure if it still goes or not. But anyway, it was an amateur thing. And Jack Nicklaus and Tony Jacklin were involved in it. And it was in Florida, and Garth was out there as a captain of the British team. And he'd taken with him a copy of that.
Which is
book that Garth was brought up on. And he was sitting beside Jack Nicklaus, and he said to Jack Nicklaus, Mr. Nicklaus, could you just sign this, please? And so he's written, to Kevin, all the best for a great job caddying Jack Nicklaus. You see that?
That's great.
That was nice. So brotherly love as well.
Yeah. Now, just quickly, I was there. I was there for the 2019 Masters. I got through the lottery, so I was there the year Tiger won, which was pretty exciting. But
yes.
As somebody who caddied there, it was quite a walk, wasn't it?
It was, and it was a wet Masters. I slipped one time coming down the. The 10th, and I fell on my backside.
Yes,
and that white overall was just splattered, and I had to take it into the caddy shack when I got back, and the caddy master wasn't at all impressed.
That's a steep hole. Did you get to caddy for four rounds or just two?
Just the two. Yeah.
Well, it's pretty special.
Well, he went out the next year, and he did the two as well, but the two rides we played with Arnold Palmer, which was pretty awesome.
Yeah,
and Arnold wasn't particularly sociable. He was still thinking he was he was going to win this thing. Yeah. And he wasn't going to spend much time with an amateur, but he did say one time Garth hit a shot and Arnold Palmer said, "Good shot, son."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, that was high praise.
That's
that was
very high praise. Nice.
Yeah. So that was good. Yeah.
Well, that's great. What a wonderful memory.
Yeah, it was. It was great. It was. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, great talking to you. Thank you for reaching out to me.
Hope so. Hope you're not just being nice.
No, not at all. I appreciate this.
Okay. Lovely to talk to you.
Okay. Have a good evening.
And you. Keep well. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.